Hi, and welcome to the Japan Baseball Weekly Podcast. It's for the week of December 19th. It's the last show of the year. I'm John Gibson, and with me, as usual, is Jim Allen. What's happening, buddy?
I feel like I should be shooting fireworks or something. I'm good. How are you doing, man?
Fireworks for the end of the year.
No. Yeah, basically that's it.
You're supposed to be popping champagne bottles and seeing this miserable year go by. Get out of here.
2016 was a trial, but, you know, it is, you know, what can I do about it? So I'm going to enjoy the end of the year. And we've got a lot of things to talk about.
We do.
Tonight.
We do indeed. We have a quick chat with former Nippon Ham Fighters manager Trey Hillman. We've got a talk with two DeNA player personnel officials. And we're going to discuss free agents. And gosh, we got a high heat question. We got a lot of stuff to do. So let's start swinging.
Clearing the bases.
All right. Well, I was very fortunate to catch up with Trey Hillman last week in Washington, and I hadn't seen Trey in about 5 years, since he was the bench coach for the Los Angeles Dodgers.
That's the last time I spoke with him.
And Hiroki Kuroda was pitching for the Dodgers, and Joe Tigarashi was pitching for the Mets, because I saw all those guys at one time in New York City.
Awesome.
So it was great, and it was good to catch up with Trey. He was there because, and I suspected he would be, because he's now the manager of the SK Wyverns in the Korea Baseball Organization. And the SK Wyverns send their people to the winter meetings every year, so I expected to see Trey. And I was pleasantly surprised, but it was really nice. Anyway, so Trey did catch up with me. I sent him an email and asked if he was there, and then like half an hour after I left the hotel where the meetings are being held, he sent me an email while I was back at my hotel finishing stories.
Oh, hey man, it's all about timing.
It is indeed. So that was like 10:30. I got an email from Trey. I'm waiting in the lobby, man.
So, and you know what time it is when you get that email. It's time to put those stories.
Well,
hit sand, man.
Well, the time is. I noticed it because I was busy. You know, busy writing story, you know, editing and writing stories. I noticed it about 11 o'clock, and you know, I could have gone back and forth, but it was, you know, it was freezing cold. So anyway, I didn't go back. But anyway, so just a little bit of prep here with Trey Hillman. He managed the Nippon Ham Fighters from 2003 to 2007 when he went back to the States to put a priority on his family.
Right.
And then at that time, he also was offered the Kansas City Royals job. And he managed the Kansas City Royals for 2+ seasons. And then he was a bench coach for the bench coach for the Los Angeles Dodgers. And then he was in a player personnel role for the New York Yankees. And then he became the bench coach for the Houston Astros.
Okay.
So that's where Trey was. And he wasn't planning to manage in Korea, but they called and he answered. And the family issues, his kids, you know, being in high school is no longer an issue. They're out of high school. So he said, let's do it. And so anyway, we had a chance to talk to Trey. And now he's the first man to manage in MLB, NPB, and KBO.
Wow, yeah.
And he mentions Jerry Royster, who was the first American to manage in KBO a few years ago.
Mm-hmm.
So, and the other guy he mentions and we talk about is Kim, the former manager of the Wyverns. Kim is a guy I know because he came over here. Oh, well, he coached in Japan for a long time.
Mm-hmm.
And he's pretty strict. He was the one who basically drove Niger Morgan out of Korea.
Was that in a cab, a Rolls Royce?
No, he drove him all the way to Mexico. maybe it was Uber. I don't know, but he got him out of Korea, and Niger's now playing in Mexico.
Okay.
So anyway, so that's a little background as we listen to what Trey Hillman has to say.
So congratulations on
the
gig.
Thank you.
You know, we all of us, not just me, we're just happy as hell for you.
Thank you. I appreciate
it. So, first of all, you're going to be doing something nobody else has ever done.
is...
Yeah, I wasn't, honestly, Jim, I wasn't aware of that until Ken Iwamoto told me.
Okay.
And I knew that, I knew it was probably unusual. I knew about Jerry Royster.
Right. But he's never managed in Japan or the U.S. and anything
right.
higher than, what,
yeah.
AA or something.
And I didn't know at the time that I was hired. Well, at the time I found out they had interest, I didn't know that he had been the only American to ever manage in
okay.
Korea. I didn't know that. So that's a little bit of a novelty. It just shows how blessed I am to get to do it. I mean, it's pretty cool. I'm looking very forward to it. I like them.
I like the
people a lot that I'm working for.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah, you're going to be a huge change from the guy they had before.
Yeah.
Who I like very much.
Right.
I personally like him, but he's the kind
Manager
of a...
Kim.
Yeah, he's old school, wouldn't take anything from anybody, which I like, but it didn't work.
Right.
Okay, now, next question has got nothing to do with you, nothing to do with the Wyverns. Now, obviously, the only way you haven't heard of Shohei Ohtani is if you got your ears plugged up.
Right.
Now, this guy is also trying to do something new within the next year or so, which is trying to be a hitter and a pitcher at the major league level, something he's never experienced, and you've been through that the hard way.
Right.
What kind of challenge is that going to be? Now, this is a guy, his nearest comp as a hitter right now in Japan is Hideki Matsui when he was 22. His nearest comp as a pitcher is Darvish, and he's better than Darvish was.
Right. I've seen him. I've seen him three times.
Okay.
He's special. There's going to be challenges. I think the biggest challenge is going to be the unified agreement between him and the club that's in charge of
right.
him, of how they split it up.
Right.
First of all, he probably is going to demand whoever takes him, let me do both.
At least give me a chance to prove I can do both.
Right.
Yeah.
Or prove that I can't.
Yeah.
And I think it's, as cliche as this sounds, Jim, I think it's going to be a matter of how much are both parties willing to communicate about the right formula for him being able to contribute the most to the team win over 162 games.
Absolutely, 100%. Now, the other question is, now that you've been as a bench coach and advising the manager and looking at, everything you can, one of the people or one of the ideas that has been thrown at me was, if you're an American League team, can you have a pitcher who starts every sixth day or seventh day if he's giving your other starters an extra day rest every third week and he's batting as a DH three or four times a week, using him essentially the way the fighters are using him?
Right. Well, I think theoretically, you could answer that question that you certainly could if you felt comfortable with your five-man rotation.
Right.
You felt comfortable with your five-man rotation and you felt like you had a legitimate number one, two, and three.
Right.
And then you skip four and five as needed or match a Shohei up as another number one.
Right.
As you get a day off.
Right.
Then that's going to pay tremendous dividends not only for one, two, three, and Ohtani.
Yeah.
It's also going to pay dividends for four and five and your bullpen. Okay. It might even allow an American League club to carry another pitcher.
Right.
I mean, another position player rather than going with what some clubs are doing, and that's going with a minimum of 12, sometimes 13 pitchers.
So. Okay, I'm going to try not to be too crazy on that one.
Yeah.
It drives me nuts. I don't want to watch the 26th guy on the team. So.
I hear you.
But, so that's one issue, and the other one is... I think, as you said, communication, obviously, because here's a guy. I mean, obviously, I think to sign him, they're going to have to say, we'll give you a chance to fail or succeed.
Right.
But if they don't believe, I can also see half the teams in MLB say, we'll give you a chance, but it's going to be this big.
Yeah,
because they just want him to pitch and they want him to forget about this hitting stuff.
I think that that's going to have to be his own comfort level.
Right.
I think that's going to have to be his comfort level with... Again, back to communication and trust in a foreign culture.
Right.
And I think the key thing there is going to be the relationships that have already been established with whoever it is that he decides to go into business with.
Right.
He's going to have a business partner. I don't know who that's going to be.
Right.
But he's going to have somebody representing.
Yep.
And, my hopes for him as a player and being a field guy is I'm always going to default to hoping that the player does well.
Yeah.
And hoping that he's healthy and has a strong career. Because if players don't have that, then guys like me don't have jobs anyhow.
You're right.
You know? So I always pull for the player to stay healthy and have good careers, and it's he knows this without Trey Hillman saying it. He just needs to have a lot of trust and a lot of genuine loyalty and confidence in who's representing him.
Mm-hmm. The other thing is that, because obviously you've been in minor league baseball forever, and you've seen these guys, because Ohtani, you know, everybody's talking about him like he's Superman, you know, like he goes and changes in a phone booth, but he ain't. And in America, you have these guys. We have them in Japan, too. Guys like Masumi Kuwata came out of high school. He's the best hitter on his team. But, no, he's a pitcher. Yeah, he's a pitcher, he's a pitcher. Sato Haro was the same. He was a bit of a junk ball lefty, but pitcher or batter. You've had these guys in Red John Olerud. You've had guys come into the minors who you guys didn't know whether he was going to be a pitcher or a hitter. Could this change the mentality if you have somebody who's successful to say, well, you can do both?
I don't think it's necessarily going to change the mentality. I think it's going to open some eyes, provided that he is successful.
Right, that's absolutely minimum.
Yeah, at the minimum to saying, okay, we've got an anomaly here.
Right.
So now we've eliminated the question or the thought, the statement that it can't happen
right.
in Major League Baseball. So let's at least consider and be a little bit more open-minded. It eliminates, like I said, it eliminates the statement.
Right. It's impossible.
Yeah, it's impossible.
Okay.
And, you know, God bless him if he can do it.
We've really enjoyed it, you know, watching how much he's developed from month to month this year was amazing. Anyway, thank you so much.
You're welcome, buddy. It was such
a pleasure to
see you.
Pleasure
seeing you, man.
Good luck in Korea, man.
Thank you,
man. I'm going to have to get over there.
All right. Tell my Japanese friends,
man. Man,
thank you,
appreciate
man.
It.
Okay, thanks, Trey. That was a great talk. It was great talking to you.
Trey, man, dude. Hope you're doing well, man. It's good to hear your
Trey
voice.
Trey, man, dude.
It was good to hear your voice, for sure.
It was indeed. And so, would you like to comment on any of that? There wasn't a whole lot, and of course I've heard it all, so.
Yeah, well, full disclosure here, there was a longer interview, but we were only allowed to use the part about Ohtani and obviously the introduction part about his working in Korea. And so, you know, I like how you declared, and maybe he wasn't listening to every word that you said.
Ignore what Jim says until he starts waving his hands.
I have the same dilemma, like trying to keep up with all the words that spill out from you. Just, you know, it's like playing dodgeball with the.
Hold on, some just spilled out now. I got to catch them.
But so I'll give Trey a break. But I think he didn't hear you when you declared Ohtani's better than Darvish. He didn't dispute it. He didn't even react to it. And I think maybe I even agree, but I think normally, had he been prepared for that, if that was a question instead of a setup for you going into a question, I think he would have paid more attention to it and addressed it and said, well, you know, I've seen Ohtani, but I managed Darvish, and I got to say, I think this part of Darvish's pitching is better, or something like that. I expected something, but he didn't touch on it. Meaning, I think he just let that pitch go by, and it was a ball. And
that's an interesting point. But what I mean was that when Darvish was 22, and Ohtani was 22, there's no doubt who's a better pitcher.
I wasn't even disputing.
Right.
You know, myself, my statement is that
I think he may have heard it.
Managed Darvish,
right?
And has seen
him heard it
on his worst day and seen him on his best day, and a guy who has also seen Ohtani pitch live didn't comment on that. That's
maybe
my.
He
point.
Agreed with me.
Yeah, that's my. Maybe he agreed with me. I don't know. I think it was. he didn't see the pitch. But anyway, what I want to focus on is this.
That's mean.
I consider Trey, and let me preface these comments by saying this. I would put him in the class of understanding Asian baseball, but not necessarily being on the side of Asian baseball.
Mm-hmm.
because he has a foot, maybe not even a foot, maybe a few toes he has in Asian baseball. But I mean, I think his heart and his roots come from the United States. And anyway, he's highly educated about the level of baseball we're talking about here in Japan versus the level of baseball in the minor leagues and the major leagues back in the United States. So I give a lot of weight to his opinion. And when he says it's possible, or I think people can open their minds to the concept of modern day Babe Ruth guy who's a hitter and a pitcher, I think, and that's not just because it's a guy who everyone is talking about. And I do mean everyone, because if he has seen him and everyone's talking, I mean, a lot of people are talking about, I'm sure many scouts and many teams have approached him and asked him, what about this kid, Ohtani, what's the level of Japan? So they're trying to gauge what they're looking at in terms of a guy. We see the numbers all the time, right? So in terms of a guy who's young and might possibly want to come over and do both and try to do both. So when he says that teams, I don't know that he said that teams are, but it seems like teams are open to the idea or the suggestion that he do both.
Yep.
To me, that gave me a lot of, it gave me cause to pause. Let's put it that way.
Oh, really? I mean, everybody is pretty much, everybody I've talked to. I mean, I've talked to basically the older the guy I'm talking to, the more likely he's about to say, we don't want him hitting.
Right.
Even the guys who are more open-minded about it will say he has more value as a pitcher. And I don't think that seems to be the most common view. He has more value right now perceived as a pitcher. And I think that's fairly common. Now, what happens is you still have people saying, we don't want him to hit. But the problem with that is he wants to hit.
Right.
And that's the huge difference. And nobody is going to sign him saying, well, you know, we're willing to pay you a lot of money, which we'll get to later, but another day. We're willing to pay you a lot of money, but we don't want you to hit, because then he'll say next.
Yeah, I like the way Trey framed it. He says there's a negotiation that's going to take place. There's going to be a meeting at the table and a meeting of the minds, and otherwise, if there isn't going to be a meeting of the at the contract signing. So.
Well, and the other part of that, which is so much more, and a lot of what he said is so much more relevant now, but because of other developments.
What do you mean?
Well, because of the CBA.
Oh, the CBA. Okay. All right.
I mean, all the stuff that relates to the agent is more relevant now because of the CBA.
And we'll talk about that in probably sometime next year, early next year. We'll talk about the CBA and the changes.
Or go read the or y'all just go read the newspaper.
You can't believe everything you read in the newspaper. What are you talking about?
Okay.
It's podcast now these days. You know, it's podcast. Okay. It's shows. Anyway.
I
love it. I think, you know, you see a lot of numbers from players, and I think people in the States really can't distinguish or make much of those numbers. And I think probably Trey is a guy who can look at the numbers and say, okay, I can gauge, I have a pretty good idea of what this means, what it translates to in terms of, I mean, once he sees Ohtani pitch, I'm not saying he can look at the numbers and see, you know, he's got these magic glasses that convey what Ohtani
I was wondering
do.
What those specs he was wearing. They were magic glasses. Damn.
But I think he has a better idea of what they mean and what they can do. And I thought that was the biggest thing. You know, it was a short 6-minute chat there. You talked about Korea a little bit, so for me that was kind of profound that stood out for me, that it seems like the whole, and I have a friend who lives in England, and he's a baseball fan, big Angels fan, and even he had heard about Ohtani. So this is a phenomenon that's really taking on. I mean, I wish he had been moving over to the States this offseason, because it seems like he's at the peak of his fame at the moment, even though he's in Japan and no one really has seen him pitch or play or hit.
Yeah, I think that's interesting. I think the bit that you mentioned about the agents is really relevant, because so much and just, you know, leaving contract value aside, which is a huge issue, the real thing that we were talking about was, how do you how do you sort out the teams that want to say, you know, we'll let you hit because we want, only because we want to sign you, and from the teams that really want you as a hitter?
Yeah,
you know,
that's
the huge point.
Yeah, that's a great dynamic where, you know, he's got to decipher when they go into these meetings, does this team, are they allowing me to hit or does it want me to hit?
Exactly. And one of the interesting things I picked up in Washington, because I asked a number of people this, and I was surprised at the answer I got. Barry Bloom, my buddy with MLB.com, said, you know what? There are 29 major league teams who, if the front office decided Ohtani had a chance to contribute as a hitter,
mm-hmm.
their manager would be on board with it. And the 30th team is the Baltimore Orioles. because he said Buck Showalter is the lone dinosaur left in MLB.
Oh.
He said basically,
welcome to Jurassic Ballpark.
Camden Yards and Jurassic Ballpark. forgive me, John. Okay, different John. So the point, Barry wasn't the only one who said it. A number of people said, look, if the front office thinks this is the way we're going to go and the manager isn't completely on board, that manager could look for a new job.
Mm, good. That's so good to hear.
So that was really a surprise to me. But anyway, of course, you know, most of the front offices include the manager's viewpoint.
Right.
But anyway, so that was big for me. And I guess the other one was my tack on the discussion I had with some scouts this summer is could a major league team do the fighter's trick, you know, 3 days as a DH and one day a week on the mound. So what really surprised me was Trey's analysis of how that might play out, where Ohtani could pitch once a week and bat three or four times a week, because basically all the answers I've gotten up until now was I guess it could work somehow. You know, and he was, you know, as a bench coach, he's really into the details.
Mm-hmm.
You know, how could this work? And I could see, you know, you could see it's, you know, what occurred to me is he had given this some thought. That answer was too smooth and too quick and too well packaged that he, to his not having given it some thought, which tells me he might have been talking with the Houston Astros about Shohei Ohtani.
Oh, yeah, you know, we talked about it this past year, and I think I was the one who said, well, look, he doesn't have to play and he doesn't have to pitch every day. He can still pitch once a week.
Mm-hmm.
He can be, I can't remember what show it was. He can be that guy who's like a floating starter.
Mm-hmm.
And you've got, the basic thing is in the States, they don't have a lot of days off during the month.
Mm-hmm.
So I like the way Trey phrased it, was like a spot starter who just starts once a week.
Yeah, basically, yeah, if he starts every fifth day, if he has 5 days rest or 6 days rest.
Right, and that gives you a guy at the back end of your rotation an extra day to rest, or you can skip him or whatever. I mean, there were a lot of options because I just loved it. We talked about it earlier this year.
Sure.
I think that was the thing that I plotted out. I said, look, he can bat, he can have a day off, and then he can pitch.
Mm-hmm.
And you could work it out. So, yeah.
Again,
very, very profound statements from a guy who's involved with Major League Baseball and knows how it works.
Yeah. I think your point about him having a toehold in Asia is so important, because most of the people you speak to in MLB, everything is so black and white. We have a 5-man staff. Ohtani will never be posted because we know how much of a fuss the Rakuten Eagles put up over $20 million for Masahiro Tanaka. And Ohtani's worth so much more, so there's no way the fighters will ever post him. And there's, you know, basically everything in America is about the way we do things in America, and it's about dollars and cents and America and Major League bean counting. I mean, it's overwhelming the lack of feel that they have. I mean, it shouldn't be surprising.
Yeah, yeah.
An overwhelming lack of feel, and I say that with all due respect for the way things work outside of the United States. Okay.
Okay, so yeah, we could talk about this forever. I know you had some more interviews while you were at the winter meeting, so tell us what you have coming up here next.
Okay, next, I have the great pleasure, as I always do at the winter meetings, of sitting down and talking with the guys from the DNA Bay Stars. In this case was international director Lyle Yates, who I've known for years when he was with the Lotem Marines under Bobby Valentine, and overseas scout Louis Lopez, former Hiroshima Carp player and Dye Hawks player. And they're always there. They're always available. They're always friendly. And we were just chatting about this and that. And somehow, I can't remember how, the conversation turned to the strike zone and pitching inside. So that's where we pick it up, you know, talking about these guys who don't want to pitch inside. And Louis Lopez basically comes out and said, you know, you got to give that hitter 17 inches across to adjust to. And that's what you're going to hear.
Yeah, so we'll pick this up right in the middle of the conversation.
You have to have that 17-inch adjustment. If I only have to adjust half that, it's to my advantage. And there are pitchers that are going to, you know who they are going to throw you in. And you know guys that are just going to throw you in the shell. And then you're going to guys that are just going to live outside. And you as a hitter have to make that adjustment. You have to know. You have to know before you go into that play who it is.
Okay, now one of the things that Matt Merton told me that was really interesting is this pitch that's so popular in Japan, less so now than it used to be, which is the two-strike pitch a foot out of the zone. Now what he told me, and this is what I want your opinion, what he told me was, I thought that was stupid too, but it messes up his perception of where the edge of the plate was. Then the next pitch would be 2 inches off the plate, and to him it looked like it was in the zone. And then when he'd go back on the video and look, that thing wasn't even in the zone. What was I swinging?
Right. That's interesting. I never experienced that when I was playing.
Okay.
But I can see where that can mess up a hitter, where it's way out there. Now, if it's still outside but it's close, I'd probably swing at it too. I try to protect the play. So I get where he's coming from.
Okay.
But I saw that this year with Moscoso. Our Moscoso, with a young catcher calling the game for him. And when he did that so far off the plate, it actually didn't hurt the hitter, it hurt Moscoso.
Yeah.
Because he was not used to throwing the ball way over.
Right. It threw him off his rhythm.
So it had the opposite effect of what they were trying to achieve. It hurt our pitcher, not the hitter.
And like I said before, you got to know who that guy is. Is he capable? Does he have that command? If he can do that, there are guys that can't do that.
Exactly.
So you need to know who's on that mound.
Yeah.
That's why it becomes a thinking man's game out there. It's cat and mouse. I know this guy can do that. So when I get into that position, now what do I do? But I understand that it can possibly happen. But there are guys that can't do that, so you just eliminate them.
That's exactly right. And as a pitching coach, talking about throwing inside, you have to throw inside. If you don't throw inside, then you're giving away, like Louis says, a part of the play. But on top of that, you've got to make a hitter uncomfortable. If he's comfortable, he's already has an edge on you. So you've got to move some feet. You've got to let him know you're throwing inside here. That's going to give you more options. But if you give away the inner half of the plate, like Louis says, now a hitter has only to look at that part of the plate besides the pitch. Big advantage to the hitter. Right, Louis?
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Now let me ask you about Tobashira, if you mentioned him. Now he got amazing reviews because Alex came into spring training and I talked to him, I don't know, but 3 days before spring training, and he said, number one, he's gonna be working with the battery, getting the catchers, and getting them to attack hitters, first strike, running the game. He said, that's my number one priority. He had about 10 priorities, but number one was the catchers. And then we came out and we saw that 1.9 ERA, the Bob Gibson team ERA in April.
Ooh.
And everybody was saying, it's the catcher. Of course, that didn't last.
Right.
Because, you can't surprise everybody every game all the time. But
You obviously were paying close attention to what Tobasha was doing on occasion.
I only saw him in spring camp in Okinawa. That was my only exposure to him. I didn't see him in the regular season. But I was impressed with him, and I was actually more impressed on the offensive side. He had a good swing. When we were watching him, I thought he had a good swing.
Right.
I didn't know how that would hold up during the season, but as far as calling pitches, it was tough to gauge it in spring because the pitchers are working on certain things.
Okay.
The catchers are getting to know him a little bit, but I didn't see him in the regular season.
Yeah, I agree with Tony. We were there. We were watching. He actually had a nice spring training with his bat.
That disappeared. Came back in the second half.
That's what happens in spring training, you know. Guys are working on one pitch. Guys are trying to get ready. Some guys are doing better than others. But until that, you know, until the bell rings, you know, then you really know what you're made. But having, you know, as a pitcher, as a catcher who caught a long time, you got to get ahead. You get ahead, you're going to be fine. As a hitter, I know he wants to throw first pitch strike. I'm going to be ready. You know, if it's in my zone, I'm going to hack at it. If he fits it middle away or something, okay.
Yeah.
But, yeah, you got to get ahead. You can't it's hard to play catch-up anything.
Sure.
Catch-up, you know, if you're down five runs or you're down in the count, it's advantage other team or the hitter. So.
Yeah, I think that whole approach gave the base runners such a nice head start. Even though they didn't win a lot of games early, they were getting a lot of good results in the first half of the season. I noticed, you know, and one of the things I noticed was that when their hitters, because their hitters were told to go out for the first strike, and that caused a lot of friction. Some of the players, it's like, no, that's not what I do.
Mm.
And I'll just say, no, this is what you do. And the coach, and Shinda, told me, he said, look, we got other people who want your job. If you don't want to swing at the first, if you don't want to go at the swing at the first strike, I'll find somebody who does. You know, you can learn this. This is what we're going to do.
Yes. Right.
And he said, everybody's got to make an adjustment. He said, the coach has got to make an adjustment. The player's got to, and we're going to do our best to help you, but you got to work with us. You can't say, no, I'm not going to do it because it's not me.
Right.
No, you know what? I'm okay with that philosophy because if you're taking something right down the middle first pitch, you may not see that the rest of the game.
Right.
You know, that first pitch, you may hack it for a double. Home run, it's going to cause the pitchers on the other teams to start either nitpicking.
Right.
They're not going to throw anything down the middle. They're going to start, you know, it's putting pressure on them. But then you evolve. Then you have to make the adjustments later on. You know what? I'm going to take this first pitch.
Right.
You know? I've taken first pitches, and when it's men on base, the guy throws the one right, whack, I bushwhack him. I ambush him, and, you know, RBI, we're up. So, again, it's a cat and mouse game. You know, but I understand what the philosophy is, and then during the season you want to, okay, now that we're there, people know it, let's switch the game plan.
Well, what happened was, and when I talked about the adjustments, was what I noticed was in May, I did a story on it, and I talked to the guys, and I talked to Mitsuyama, who I love, and basically the thing was, you know, we're going to, as hitters, go after the first strike. As pitchers and catchers, we're going to try to throw first pitch, first strike.
Right.
And what happened was, on the hitting side, more than anything, any count where the guy put the ball in play, 1-0, 2-0, 3-0, Bay Stars were like, they weren't maybe the best hitters in the league, but 1-0, 2-0, and 3-0 they were.
Right.
I mean, incredible, and much better. Now, they didn't get deep in counts.
Right.
But if you fell behind in the count and they're looking for the first strike, they murdered them.
Right.
But then everybody made an adjustment.
Right.
You know, that was a big thing for them.
Right.
And nobody else could quite catch it. They couldn't quite catch up to that adjustment with another one.
Right, right.
You remember Narute, of course, when he was with Lotte.
Sure.
You know how many first pitch strikes he threw? And it was in the same area over and over and over again? Do you remember that?
I don't remember.
And the philosophy was, and it's something we would always talk about, look, if they're not swinging, keep throwing.
Yeah.
And that's exactly what he did. And until they made an adjustment, keep throwing it. Because he had terrific command, you remember?
Yeah.
So the philosophy there is, like you're talking about, look, if I see they're not making an adjustment, I'm not going to adjust. If there's an adjustment, then I'll adjust. If they're not swinging first pitch, I'll throw the first pitch strike. Same place.
Yeah, it's a game of adjustments. You gotta follow what's going on, just like anything else. He's 100% right. If they're not swinging, I'm going to keep planting him right there until they show me, okay, now they're starting to swing first pitch. Or maybe I'll drop it off the plate. Now they start grounding out
first pitch. Yeah.
You know, I mean, first pitch strike for a pitcher, yeah, doesn't mean it's got to be down the middle, middle away, middle in, up and, you know. And if they're not swinging, they keep throwing it. Once they start swinging, you start moving it away.
That's right. I see it with the, you know, and I see it in the majors with the Japanese pitchers. It's almost like they come to the game with a few extra strikes in their pocket because these guys are not geared up looking for first pitch curveball down the middle.
Right.
Yeah. And it's like, okay, thank you, I'll take it. Right. And they keep doing it until somebody hits them.
Right.
But I watch, you know, it stopped working for Myatt until he went back to his four seam.
Right.
A bit.
Again, true. Yeah. You have to have something besides that.
Yeah.
Okay. Thanks, guys. Always great catching up with you. Great pleasure. Thanks for sharing your time with me.
Yeah, that was great. I don't know. I haven't met Luis Lopez as far as I remember, but that guy has so much energy. I just want to bring him over, put him on a treadmill, and hook him up to a machine that powers my apartment here so that I don't have to pay TEPCO any more money.
That's what you got babies for.
I think he would run the place. I think I could store up some energy with that guy. He's just got enthusiasm. Get out.
He does.
Awesome.
He does.
And Lyle was really, I mean, both very insightful guys.
Mm.
Really great to hear from them. What can I say? I love the enthusiasm. I can only imagine what Lopez was like as a player. But what stood out most for me was the notion that Lyle touched upon about pitching inside. And because we see it in Japan so much that these guys are not willing to throw the ball in the inner half. Now, they'll throw inside off the plate, and they'll bat guys out of the batter's box sometimes. They'll even hit a couple guys here and there, but they won't try to throw the ball over the plate on the inner half. They'll look to get guys out on the outer half and or get a call. You know, they'll try to paint the black, get a call, and they'll pitch to survive. But they don't use the inside part of the plate as a means of getting guys out. And it's not a great recipe for success, and it drives me nuts. And I love what Lyle was talking about with Naruse. I think they were both talking about it, but his ability to locate. And it seems like to me that Naruse, his location, he just lost it. He just doesn't have it. And he used to have a lot of deception. And I think Paul Pupo with the Marines, the statistical god, and he said Naruse has this deception where it looks like the ball is actually released a little bit closer than it seems. Like his fastball jumps on you and it gets there faster because of his release and everything. Mm-hmm. But it seemed like he the injuries have just mounted and he just doesn't have enough velocity to do anything. Mm. And he can't keep anybody off of any certain pitches. So he struggled in recent years, but he's a perfect example because he's a guy who, you know, he'll use the inside part of the plate to work batters a little bit, but he didn't seem to use it to get guys out.
Mm-hmm. Well, I always liked Naruse was always a puzzle for me because basically he spent his career work, you know, usually when you, I'm trying to think of a similar pitcher, but you know, when Tsuyoshi Wada went to the United States, he became a Naruse type player, which is a lot, you know, he had a few dropping pitches, but basically he tried to get guys out up in the zone, try to get fly balls. Naruse has lost, he's lost a little bit. I think I asked him what the issue was with him after he had a good game this year. And he said, I'm just not physically, I'm not as good as I had been. So I think he lost a little bit of the oomph he needed. That was a breaking point for him.
Right, right.
I don't think he has the command, you know, for him to throw as hard as he once did or as he feels he needs to. He loses some of the command that he needs. So it's difficult. I think so when he has a good day, it's more of a case of he's really got a lot of strength.
Yeah. So, yeah, I like those guys talking about that. And I also like Lyle pointing out that Yasutaka Tobashira, the catcher for the Bay Stars, and saying that he had a nice swing because that was the first thing that I noticed. I'm like, I like the way this guy swings. But, you know, he didn't make a lot of contact. He didn't drive the ball. He didn't.
But towards the second half, he actually looked like a hitter.
No, I meant when I first saw him.
Right.
When I
the first half, him, yeah. No, I thought, wow, okay.
And he got better, of course, and I think this season of him going through the the whole league number of mm-hmm. times, seeing all the players, seeing all his pitchers react on the mound, seeing what they can do in different situations, different circumstances. I think that's just going to do nothing but benefit him. And then he mm-hmm. is also going to be used to swinging on this level. Mm-hmm. And I think he's going to be better this next season. But
yeah.
I really like the fact that they pointed out his swing, because we've always talked about his catching and his calling games mm-hmm. and what a thinking man he is behind the plate and all that stuff. But I think he's going to be able to hit too, and I'm excited to see what he does this next season. So, yeah, it was good.
Yeah, it was. I remember we started the conversation talking about Alex Ramirez, but other than that, I don't remember remember much. It was very animated though, and it was a great pleasure. I get to talk to a lot of the NPB people, which was fun, and the whole new Oryx gang.
Well. I'll save my comments about Oryx for next year.
We'll see. You gotta like the fact that they just changed the whole scheme.
Whatever. And next time, throw the baby out with the bathwater. Let's make a four-stream transition and talk about the free agents market. We've had a lot of players moving this offseason here.
Mm-hmm.
And a couple of things stood out to me. And one was the fact that, and I saw this, and when I saw the headline in the paper the other day, mm-hmm. I was reading the Yomiuri, of course, and it said, you know, the Giants signed three free agents in the same offseason mm-hmm. for the first time.
Okay.
And so I just assumed it was the first time in their history. So then I picked up the article and I'm reading and it says free agency in its current state since 1993. Mm-hmm. No team had ever signed three players
mm-hmm.
in a one free agent season or mm-hmm. in the off season when free agents were moving around. And the Giants have signed Masahiko Morifuku mm-hmm. from the Hawks. They signed Shun Yamaguchi from the DeNA Bay Stars. And they signed Yo Daikon, or Yes We Can, or Yang Daikon to his friends back home in Taiwan, to his peeps.
And to me.
And so I'm just looking at these moves for them, and I thought, well, okay, they're signing three, but two out of three ain't bad, and I can't see all three them hitting on all three, because we know the Giants' history in free agents. They've flopped on them, or guys have come over there, and they just haven't been able to get it done for whatever reason in history.
Well, I remember back in my days at the Daily Yomiuri, and we used to put out a big preseason special.
I remember that thing. Oh, my God. That was 10 years ago.
Yeah, a long time ago. And, I looked back at all the Giants free agent acquisition seasons, and most of them had not been good. 2000 was a good year. 2007 was a good year. 2008, when they signed Alex Ramirez, he wasn't one of the Japanese guys who filed for free agency. He was an unsigned free agent, but they had 2 years where they brought in big players from Japan. Ogasawara MVP, Ramirez MVP. So, you know, things have improved for them. They haven't just been taking the biggest name off the top of the heap, as used to be their custom.
Yeah, but I have to say, I like Yo, the acquisition of Yo, or Young, or Kong, or whatever you want to call him. I think he's going to play a good role for them at the mm-hmm. top of the lineup. They want to put him in center field. And like I said,
yeah.
I think that the Giants have all these little slap-and-run, waterbug type, you know, armless, really good defensive center field guys who you could replace him with. I mean, they're interchangeable. They're like cookie cutter guys. I don't think Yo fits into that. He's got some power. Mm-hmm. They're probably going to expect more RBIs out of him. They can move him up mm-hmm. and down, maybe bat him second, third sometimes if need
sure.
be.
He's second, a... second.
Oh, wait.
Second, wait.
Stop
no, you
bunting.
Need a guy. Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Second. Well, can you bunt? Well, I guess we got to sit you on the bench, boy.
But, wow. He's got a much better arm. He's going to be able to play comparable defense to
yeah, defense. But Young gets really good jumps, and I think he's probably better. He's probably, you know, he's a step ahead of all those guys defensively.
But he's got a better arm. Whatever he doesn't catch, he'll make up with, you know, with the gun. So yeah.
Sure.
Okay.
Hey, well, I think your point's valid, you know, in that he's a step above everybody else. But one of the things about the Giants is they can't seem to sort through their players, and One of the reasons for that is guys get hurt, and one of the guys I do really like is Itaro Hashimoto, but it seems like he's hurt every other year.
Matsumoto's hurt.
Matsumoto's done.
He's Tateoka, done. They all, something. There's something. There's some major flaw with all of them. Even the Shinosuke almost. Shigenobu, the guy who they brought up last year at the, you know, for the beginning of the season. Mm-hmm. And the rookie, and you know, they all have little flaws. I think Yo's going to fit in there really well. Yeah, so I like what he's going to do. You know, mm-hmm. Yamaguchi is a guy who, since he has been moved to the rotation, he's been really, really effective. But I'm just not sure if he's going to be able to keep that up. He might be better. I don't know. But I'm looking at Morifuku as the guy who's the odd man out. I just, you know, in recent years, I don't know that he's been used the right way. If there's anybody who has a chance of not working out, I think it's him. And while I don't think that he was used, you know, the way that we were used to seeing him, he was a left-handed specialist. He came in, but he could pitch to right-handed batters, and he did a lot of work in the postseason getting guys out. But I'm just not sure that. You know, he's going to come over to the Central League, which we know is a little bit more inferior. He's going to be able to face different guys. If he can get that slider back to the way it was, if he can get some velocity with that fastball, I think he's going to be effective for him. But I just, you know, if I had to bet, I would say he's the guy who's not going to work out for them.
Oh, I absolutely disagree. And the reason I
know I
disagree,
you love him, yeah.
I don't love. I could care less about him.
No. We talked about him long ago, and you
right.
you saw his numbers in the minor leagues, and you said, "Why is
right.
this guy not pitching?" You've got an affinity for him. Admit it. This is not national TV. You can admit it, like you were on last night.
John's having an issue right now.
It's called the truth.
Well, when you find it, let me know. Okay, so anyway.
I'm trying to let you know you're closing your eyes.
No, the point is, no, and I actually haven't been I was a fan of Morifuku before he got to the first team, and I was a fan of him when he got some exposure early on. But basically, I was watching his performance drop every single year until Kudo last year said, "Hey, you know what? You're not getting right-handers out anymore." And that was the problem. He wasn't getting right-handers out anymore.
Right.
And it's not that he was being used incorrectly with SoftBank. It was that they were using him against right-handers, and it wasn't working. So anyway,
minute. That's not using him the right way, isn't it?
Well, and last year that wasn't a problem because they used him against left-handers and his numbers were better than ever.
Okay.
Well, so so last year they used him fine. And here's the thing is, I think he works well out of that pen because the lefty they've been depending on is
Tetsuya Yamaguchi.
And Tetsuya Yamaguchi has been hit and miss, and they've been big hits.
Yeah, he's getting a sore neck from watching balls whiz by.
Yeah, I think they just got tired of, you know, seeing lefties hit him, take him out of the park in the eighth or ninth inning. Yeah. So that's an interesting thing. Shun Yamaguchi from the DeNA BayStars, I think is a pretty good thing. But, you know, I like him, but what I don't trust is the Giants' ability to use him.
Okay,
now the other, and speaking of acquisitions, the Giants haven't stopped with the Japanese free, you know, the domestic free agents. They, you know, as I said, they kind of a crowded outfield, but Young's better than the rest. So other than Chono, who's probably a better player, but he's better than the rest of the guys. But they've also got Garrett Jones in left field, so that crowds things a bit. And Garrett Jones might play first base, but Shinosuke Abe's there. And then they had a great year last year out of Shuichi Murata, which is interestingly enough, the Giants probably don't believe it really happened because they went out and got Casey McGee. And you know, the good thing about Shuichi Murata is that they're probably right. If he had, you know, he has one good year, or a good half a season.
I was going to say, it wasn't a whole an entire season, yeah.
But overall, the numbers were good. He did the same thing in 2013. So basically, every third year, he has a really good half a season, and they're probably going, well, we're going to need some help for the next 2.5 years.
Right, yeah.
So they got Casey McGee. So it's really interesting. And now I think we can move on to the other big free agent acquisition.
Yeah, for me, I don't know what you're talking about, but for me, it was Yoshio Itoi going to the Hanshin Tigers. What was it for you?
It was Yoshio Itoi going to the Hanshin Tigers.
And I found this puzzling, personally. I haven't looked at all the numbers, so and I really should, and I will sit down sometime.
Okay. Well, just tell me what puzzles you about this.
I'm just looking at the outfield, and we know that Kosuke Fukudome had a really good season, even though he's, what, 40-ish?
Yep.
And maybe they don't think that that can hold up. Mm-hmm. We saw the young rookie, Shun Takayama. Mm-hmm. He had a good season, you know, for a rookie, but defensively sure. He had his questions. And we know Yoshio Itoi is a good outfielder. In fact, I'm looking at that outfield. I don't see a center fielder among those three.
I don't see a center fielder in Itoi anymore, but...
Heck no. But I see a right fielder, and I think if you don't put him in right, you're wasting his arm. But then if you put,
Where's Fukudome going to play?
Exactly. You've got a problem. There's not a center fielder among those three. There's really not even a good... Well, I mean, Fukudome has won his gold gloves, but again, he's 40-ish and had some leg problems, some lower body problems toward the end of the season last year, or this season, this past season. And they had a bunch of guys playing the outfield as well. There's some other players out there. They sure do.
Taiga Egoshi can play center.
That's why it was puzzling. But can he play center? Is he going to play center? And who's going to be playing left? And who's going to be playing playing?
Well, Takayama can't play any place but left because there's no DH in the Central.
I was
going to
say he should be playing bench.
He should be. He should be a pinch hitter. Right.
Maybe he's going to get better. Maybe he's working
on that. But Egoshi can play center. And, of course, the other solution is they have several second basemen. And I think it, as much as I, you know, one of the things that I just love about Japanese baseball is this fondness for center fielders who can't throw and second basemen, you know, who are pretty good at the double play, and then switching those two guys, and it's usually the same guy. Look at these centers. You know, it's like what other league? Yamato Maeda, who's a can really go get it in center field.
He's a great defensive player. I think he could play wherever they put him. He would play well. I really think
He doesn't have a good arm, but he's got a better arm than most of these second base. This fleet. I mean, Japanese baseball history is littered with these guys who are second baseman, center fielders. And if your name is, you know, oddly enough, when I was first following Japanese baseball or a few years into it, they had two guys named Koichi Ogata who were both at one point in their career center field second baseman. Okay, although the carp Koichi Ogata then was a right field second baseman, which is a little less common. But it's like every second baseman in Japan, the first question they ask you when you turn pro is, how do you feel about center field?
Yeah, well, how do I feel about this move? I feel really puzzled and confused, and I'm going to see how this... I'm going to really keep my eye on how this works out. Because
You monitor that situation,
Mr.
Gibson.
That situation. But in the meantime, let's go to fielding questions. So our question this week comes from @CoasterFreak, and he says, in MLB, TV money is where teams get their revenue. Which is the best source of revenue for NPB teams? #HighHeat.
Wow, good question. I wish I knew. TV money used to be the big deal. The TV money basically was what kept three of the Central League teams afloat. You know, their 13 home games against the Giants that they could sell for big bucks. But that's, you know, those days are gone, which is why the teams play the Giants in you know, during day games and things, and licensing maybe, because the teams have 100% licensing rights. Probably not merchandising so much, because most of the teams don't have the concessions revenues from their home ballparks, because they're leased without, you know, they work without operating rights. For the same reason, teams don't get to keep much of their ticket revenue,
right?
Or their, you know, their advertising revenue. So most of the teams get zero advertising, zero concessions, very little of the ticket sales. So TV and licensing, probably all the advertising revenue at Tokyo Dome goes to Tokyo Dome, not to the Giants, who pay rent. Now, they do have, the Giants get a huge amount of money from sponsorships, which is why they have things like Ito Ham promotions.
Right.
Because Ito Ham will sell Giants promotions.
Right.
Those things are huge, especially for the Giants. And all the teams, I know when the, for example, the sponsorships are pretty good because they're not advertising. You know, the teams will have the, will have these in pregame promotions and things that aren't fixed advertising. Essentially, Ito Ham is a big Giants sponsor. And, you know, if you buy a package of sausages or something, sometimes you can get Giants tickets in raffles and things.
Okay. All right. So, yeah, I mean, you know, we've got the wave of things like Paw League TV. Mm-hmm. There's Sports Navi on mm-hmm. Yahoo, and they're signing. I mean, last year the DNA Bay Stars, they were showing games on the Sports Navi, and you could sign mm-hmm. up for that, and that was a way for teams to work out deals with these. It's not TV deals, but they're, you know, internet.
Well, they're broadcasting rights, sure,
broadcasting rights, and all that stuff. So I think that's probably where the main source of incomes come from. But yeah, I was leaving that to you.
Well, the future is certainly to do what a lot of the teams are doing, which is purchasing their stadiums. I mean, the Fighters are going to move out of Sapporo Dome. I think there's no doubt about that. They can't make money in Sapporo Dome because they don't get to keep the ticket sales, concessions, or advertising. So they get, I mean, they keep a fraction of the ticket sales. They turn over a huge portion of that to the city of Sapporo. And that's why the DNA Bay Stars purchased a controlling interest in Yokohama Stadium last year, and they're going to be able to modify that. And why? So the teams are basically eventually going to go one by one into owning their own facilities. I know the Giants are still looking at, I understand the Giants are looking at Tsukiji if the fish market ever leaves.
Stinky fish. I've been saying that all season. Well,
don't you be talking about my
football,
team
huh?
like that.
Okay.
Oh, okay. Sorry. All right. Don't you be talking about my teams. All right. So anyway, so that is the wave of the future. But right now, yeah, how do Japanese teams make their money? Is the answer is most of them don't. Although the Hiroshima Carp, if I had to answer that one, their big thing is merchandise.
Well, yeah, the question was how they make most of their money. And the one other thing that I did find was that a lot of these parent companies of the teams, especially mm-hmm. the ones like the Giants or Nippon Ham, can write off
yep.
Losses mm-hmm. because they are the parent company. And so that's yep. how they make up or actually keep the teams going, because they're not making money.
Yeah, most of them. The Giants have always are probably the big money earner in the Yomiuri Group right now. But but teams and the Carp, interestingly enough, however, are the one team that always turns a profit.
Okay.
And the way they do that is they've traditionally paid very little for their players, and they have been extremely good at selling merchandise. So.
Yep. All right. Well, we've got to sell off here and get out. And
wow.
Say goodbye.
We're sellouts.
Say goodbye for the year. We will talk to you again next year. I'm not exactly sure when, but we will. I'll send out a little note on Twitter and let everybody know.
Okay, well, thanks for listening and staying with us for the whole year, guys. I'm impressed with your patience.
And we will talk to you next year. Enjoy your holidays.
Happy New Year.